previously on Getting the Mecha.
As a result, anime could take greater strides, as if we go back to first-gen animators like Kitayama, he couldn't really afford that much to keep an anime studio going, and now, in the 1960s, this was an optimal time for anime. I think my view, or maybe my definition of sakuga, is that it's the art of respecting the small things, or at least it has taught me to respect the intricacies that are put in there, the nuances in production.
This is Getting the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes, in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it.
Welcome back to Getting the Mecha, I'm your host Jamal today. Hopefully you guys are safe and doing well, and in this episode we are talking sakuga. More specifically, fighting sakuga. So in today's episode, it's been almost 20 weeks since I last did a sakuga episode, and I've been kind of wanting to do one ever since, and I've had some amazing experiences with animation and sakuga and cinematography recently. I've watched some great shows which have really shown off how good it can really get. I thought it was the perfect time to make one, and as I said last episode, we have a lot of time to think and bathe in our own minds. So I just wanted to put this one together for this week. I kind of did it on a whim. In this episode, we will be looking at three anime, I think, which really show what fighting sakuga is really about, and these are all recent-ish examples from both this year and last year, so 2020 and 2019. I'll get more into those details a bit later into the podcast. So, without any more wasting of time, here is the episode for this week. That is episode 39 of Guest of the Mecha, The Art of Fighting Sakuga. Last time we did discuss sakuga on Get to the Mecha, I believe that was on episode 25, Understanding Sakuga. We looked quite closely at animation as a whole and its history and how it managed to get there. And I'm not really going to go over that in today's episode, but I want to be a bit more conceptual this time and look closely at what sakuga is and relate that to fighting sakuga in itself. So last episode we established that sakuga is effectively, in its rawest form, about drawings and pictures and motion, and that all put together produces movement, and that movement portrays events within the anime. Motion in itself is the cornerstone of the visual part of our audiovisual media, and so animators work to put this together within frames to create movement and build up that visual component of which we know. However, if we are to be a bit more specific in relation to the topic today, where we are talking about fighting sakuga, I don't mean to be pedantic, but we have to be quite specific as to what a fight is as a concept. According to the Cambridge Dictionary, no mean to be fancy, but according to the lovely Cambridge Dictionary on the internet, it refers to a fight as, by definition, to use physical force to try and defeat another person. And I decided to run with that definition a bit more, and in the context of narrative, to be even more specific, it's a physical representation or somewhat of a representation of an antagonism within a narrative. I did think this through, and I do think it makes a lot of sense. Some may use some other examples with the likes of training fights and tournament arcs and exam arcs, and to you, I do say, yes, it is still an antagonism. Because these antagonisms are made almost consensually between the opponent and the other opponent within their eyes. In the case of a training fight, it's still an antagonism based on the fact that these are almost temporary contracts which are made out of mutual benefit for the sake of training, so someone becomes your opponent for the sake of you becoming better at fighting. And so these fights in themselves, physical fights that is, which we're referring to, are always representative of some form of antagonism, whether temporary or a true antagonism between whether that's good or evil or just conflicting beliefs in general within a narrative. That leads us to our almost final definition, and therefore we can refer to fighting Sakuga conceptually as a portrayal or representation of an antagonism through the likes of drawings and frames and imagery. We can even go further and say in the modern context, this can be done through the likes of CGI and generated imagery through a computer. The definition has expanded quite a bit, and I'm not going to be too stringent on the fact that it's drawings and pictures only, although anime is still to an extent hand-drawn, not necessarily just on paper though. But we can say that this antagonism and conflicting nature is represented within frames and drawings as is. I know it is a bit pedantic and maybe a bit over the top to define a fight and animation as is, because you probably do know at least what it is. However, I think it's just something important to keep in the back of our minds when we are referring to this, because the approach I really want to take is, what does this do, or what does said animation technique or said animator do for obtaining that thematic weight? What is this attempting to achieve? It's not only an aesthetic, if that makes sense. And just to reiterate, if you do want more context, episode 25 is a good place to get that, as we did make quite a few advancements in regards to thematic weight and how Sakuga is able to do that. And so now, let's actually get into some specific analyses to kind of contextualize what I've been talking about. And so, in this episode, I will be discussing the conclusion to My Hero Academia 4th season, the kind of conclusion to Fire Force, and some of the Sakuga of Fate's Grand Order, Absolute Demonic Front Babylonia, in this episode. So that will be spoilers for My Hero Academia 4th season, or at least its conclusion anyway. Potential spoilers again for Fire Force or Enen no Shobutai and Fate's Grand Order. I won't be going into immense amounts of detail in regards to the plot. However, there may be some character antagonisms which you might not want to be spoiled on, because you might not know how those fights arise. So let us begin. My Hero Academia episode 88 features Endeavor vs Black Nomu, and this episode honestly brought together many, many animators together. Some I believe are guest animators, whereas others are employed by Bones. And just to take you through a list of some of the names which were able to pop up within this episode, we have the almost all-star of Bones, Yutaka Nakamura, famous for his work in My Hero Academia Season 2, particularly Deku vs Todoroki. Also did a lot of work on other Bones works, including Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood, his famous scene on Sword and the Stranger, Concrete Revolutio. The list goes on forever when it comes to Nakamura, to be completely honest. Yuki Hayashi, Shun Shibata, Shu Sugita, and Yukino Kosaka. Kosaka I'm very familiar with in regards to Shingeki or Attack on Titan 2nd season, and it was a different approach to what I expected in regards to their work, but again, we will go into that. So I want to define firstly almost the objective of these cuts from these various animators of our Bones and within this episode. And I feel like the main attempt is to really portray the strength of Endeavor and definitely show off the fact that he is the number one hero now, and he is worthy of that. He is the new light for the society of which MHA is in. I honestly don't know if it has a name, but he is meant to be exemplified and portrayed as the mighty one, similarly to All Might, the face of the hero world and heroism as a concept. And so the animators are able to do that really well. There's a big focus upon synergy within the artistic style between a lot of these animators. I would say potentially Nakamura stands out for various reasons, but it's kind of a joke. However, when we think of people like Sugita, Shibata, and Kosaka, they are definitely able to merge their styles together to create an almost unified image. And that image is created through these constantly moving pencil lines, and you can see them, they're there for emphasis. A lot of the cuts, specifically within Shibata and Sugita's cuts, the ones mirroring the likes of the 3rd season, which saw All Might fight All For One, it's able to exaggerate and just show the mightiness of the character with these very thick pencil lines approaching the camera. a lot of that is just used as well to back the or pad the flames which come out of Endeavor as well, because there are times within the series where these are plain, but again, for that emphasis and for demonstrating how mighty this character is and the might which comes behind the force of these flames coming out of him from his quirk, it's very necessary, and I really credit Shibata and Sugita for being able to keep those lines in motion. In my notes, I said, and this might be stretching it, it's just to represent the constant determination of Endeavor, and I kind of do agree with that. It's consistent and it's constantly moving, which I think in itself has a message. These flames are constantly burning bright, even within a time of hardship, and so it demonstrates a lot about Endeavor's character, as well as it is just a really nice feat to show how strong he is. I would also say that my favorite cuts when it comes to the episode in general, at least this conclusion from the cuts I've seen, because I didn't necessarily finish the season, but I watched this in full kind of to gain an understanding, and I've done my reading, so I'm kind of on track here. But Yukino Kosuka, as I said, who's worked on works such as the very popular Attack on Titan, really shows how versatile they are within their style, because this is something I wouldn't expect. If you are to go back to my Attack on Titan episode back in season 2, when I spoke about one of Eren's fights, the lines I did point out, I believe, were very clean. There weren't any what you can define as messy pencil lines or outstanding lines. It was all conforming to the anatomy of said titans. But on the other hand, the prominence burn takes up a completely different skill set, and Kosuka is really able to account for that. The thing I love about these cuts when it came to the prominence burn was that I felt a lot more connected to the production as is, and it brings us closer to the animation as it's in its almost raw form. The prominence burn is animated as it sort of ignites itself as almost raw pencil lines as is. They're still in motion and they're still flickering, but there isn't any color to it. For quite a few seconds between the two cuts, of which we get one, which is a side profile shot of Endeavor switching into this form, and then the other one being when you see him in full body form taking up the, or using the prominence burn. I don't know if it's a trend, but it's a really cool thing animators have been doing, how they really have attempted to, at times, make things seem really raw and really close to how it's made, almost. That could have been in color, but for the portrayal of this raw power, this mighty power, it's necessary to strip that all down and show the true essence of Endeavor's power and the source of that. And speaking of that, I think that leads us very nicely into Nakamura. Yutaka Nakamura, as I said earlier, is probably one of the most famous animators at Bones, and potentially in general as well. He's really made a name for himself with his quite unique, and I don't want to say that he founded all these techniques, but he at least popularized them a lot more and helped to do that. So when we talk about stuff like Utapon Cubes and Utapon as a thing being this different way of portraying destruction and debris, we use blocks and cubes and rectangles instead of irregular shapes. Also impact frames as well, although again he didn't make these per se, however he uses them quite effectively within his works like Mob Psycho 100 as well. Those are those black and white frames you usually get for the sake of, as the name implies, impact. And Nakamura doesn't use all of these, but he's definitely strong on the Utapon within this episode, and we get that with the lovely UFO man cut, as well as the amazing shot of the building that the Black Nomu gets scraped through. I go on to that shot later because I have something really important and I think potentially valuable to say in relation to that. However, when it comes to the quote-unquote UFO man cut, I think that is just, it's really smart and really daring. It's something which I think you could potentially expect from Nakamura, because as an animator, he experiments with form. using squares and rectangles as is something which is a lot more, although it sounds very regular, when you perceive destruction and almost all the buildings in that one shot from the previous one, all those buildings besides the main one are very much just rectangles as is, and not really, they don't have much form factor to them. They're rendered as plain. And then the maybe famous or potentially even infamous UFO, I think that overall just represents how bold Nakamura is to experiment with form as a thing. He did have a lot more combat-focused cuts, I think, a lot early in his career, but I just respect how willing he is to try and switch things up and switch up how he portrays stuff like movement and form all the time. Recently, with the likes of My Hero Academia generally, he's tried to just experiment a lot more, and I can see that. Even the overhaul Deku fight, I think, is a really good example of keeping things a lot more tight and focused, as opposed to similarly to what he did in the likes of Season 2, where it was fast-moving objects across the screen. He kind of almost challenged himself through that, and even in Heroes Rising as well, although he does love diagonals and it really does show, he tried some different things with different characters, and that is what I think is so special about Nakamura as an animator, and also just these cuts in general. As well as I did say that synergy is a very important part of these cuts, but that doesn't mean animation cannot be pushed and experimented with in the likes of a serious fight like this one, and it's done to a very good standard, as Nakamura always seems to deliver. Similarly to the likes of Sugita, when I said they were able to almost bring animation to its rawest form, I think Nakamura does a similar thing. I kind of mentioned this in my Heroes Rising review last week, but Nakamura's smearing in general is just really blocky, kind of ironic for the likes of Utapon, but it's very blasé in its style. It's not textured very much. It's in fact just some colors with a slight gradient going into each other for portraying heat and those sorts of things. And generally as well, the way he renders things, that they don't have excessive lines. He kind of only brings those lines in for the sake of impact framing. But what I am trying to say is that both synergy and the notion of pushing animation are kind of fused together really well. It is more leaning towards the synergistic side, and I can understand that, as one needs to meet the standard of making Endeavor the number one and show him and show the audience, convince the audience that he is worthy of taking up this new mantle. But that does not stop animation from taking up all these crazy things and doing new and inventive things, as I would argue that is what it intends to do or tries to do during moments like this. I did forget though that I was going to quickly kind of discuss the building shots as well, and it's a quite simple shot, but it's also a really complex one as well, and it's more about what it represents, and I want to briefly discuss that. It is kind of in relation to what I was saying earlier on pushing animation, but I think it's the reason that enables animation and animated works to be pushed. When we look at that building shot, it's a really nice shot because of how there's a really quick transition and very quick camera movement between the full or almost full shot of the building and the very close and tight shot towards the building. This kind of also mirrors what Nakamura was trying to do in Season 4 earlier, at least by the conclusion of the Overhaul arc or Shihasaki arc with these tight shots. He experiments with that, but he also just pulls out really quickly afterwards. And what does that represent? The reason why these are possible, and the reason why people like Nakamura are able to manipulate form, and the reason why we're able to get such insane cinematography from so many animators when they are animating as such, and how directors and storyboarders are able to put this all together, the reason for that, I think, is just because, and it's rather simple, but there are no physical limits to animation. When I say this, if we look at traditional filmmaking and physical filmmaking for live action films and just films in general which aren't animated, the limits we have are the limits of both our technology in regards to its size and form. So this is something I heard on another podcast. I heard this on Matt Diavella's Ground Up show, although I don't know if you guys listen to it. If you do listen to it, it's a really good show, but it has nothing to do with anime. He's just a filmmaker and he has spoken to a lot of filmmakers. And one of his guests, I can't remember which episode, he was talking about how rigs can be used. He even connected it to anime, I think, and just Japanese animations. how these rigs can only do so much, and so he creates his own rigs in order to try and compensate for those physical limitations. We don't have to build camera rigs, or animators and animation studios and storyboarders don't have to build animation rigs, or camera rigs, in order to capture such shots. Their limit is what can be drawn and what can be generated through computer imagery, and that is a lot of things, and if anything, it's a lot more than what a camera can do and what a camera rig can do. A camera rig can do a hell of a lot when it's made well, but even that has limitations in itself. And so I think that is just a point to show how adventurous anime and Sakuga can be as is, and that's just something to appreciate, especially as we are going to look through two more works, I think, which really build on this really well. And on that note, let's switch anime. MHA was really good, I really enjoyed the points we spoke about, but let's talk about Fire Force or Enin no Shobutai. I'm specifically going to be honing in on the Netherworld arc and the battle between Sho and Shinra. Just to confirm, I don't really have many animator names, mostly because Burrow hasn't really been able to get all of them, because not every animator confirms that. But for this episode in general, I will be trying my best to get all the Burrow links, the Sakuga Burrow links, to the specific cuts which I'm referring to, and that should have the respective animators within the tags. So obviously all credit to Sakuga Burrow for being able to provide those names and credit their work, because it truly is great work. But also just to note as well, Fire Force has been made by David Production, mostly known for none other than JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, but I would say that Fire Force or Enin no Shobutai is definitely a completely different production, and even its values I feel are just very different. Not necessarily saying that JoJo's standards are poor or low, it's just generally there's a much different artistic approach to it, whereas I feel as if Fire Force has a much more cinematic element of which it tries to bring forward, and the Netherworld arc is perfect proof of that. So as I did for MHA, I'm just going to establish what this tries to do and what this fight and this animation in itself tries to do. And that is represent the duality and this opposing relationship between Shinra and Sho, of which are brothers. And I think this is done in a, I don't want to say perfect way, but at least a near perfect way, or a very good way for what I expected. The best part, I think, comes out of how, and this kind of even precedes animation, it's just how it's able to establish this very cinematic feel. I know I'm kind of overusing cinematic, but how is that portrayed? And that is done through the color grade. The color grade and the coloring is this sort of desaturated teal-like look. It's a shame that they didn't letterbox this fight and make it almost a, I'm gonna say it again, cinematic aspect ratio, but either way, it worked really well. I guess it's good to consider that in order to have one's animation and look achieve maximum effect, stuff like coloring and lighting is so important to get right, and it sets the tone so well. It's this quite bleak feel, but it's one which I just haven't seen before in general in regards to anime. The lighting and the shadows are also just used to full effect when transitioning as well between different almost acts of the fight. When the shadows come over Sho and comes over Shinra to show that he's in this frame when he manages to grab his sword. And so it's able to lay those groundworks out, which already adds to the feel of this relationship between the characters before we even go on to analyze animation as is. Another great thing is just this camera stability and how it's able to mix that up throughout the fight. So the shots within this fight are really mixed up. So we get a shaky camera a lot of the time, which is a classic thing to use, not necessarily in just anime, but for action scenes in general. I'm sure in almost any action movie you've watched, you've seen a shaky camera, whether that's in a chase scene, whether that's in sort of a messy fight scene. The shaky camera is something which has been used for ages, and it's no exception in anime as well. It's just used to showcase how rough a situation is and how raw the fight and combat is. But one thing I think is done really well is how it doesn't depend on this, and if anything, it implements stability at the perfect time. It seems to go sort of shaky, static, static, shaky, static, static. I didn't really count it, but it goes something like that from what I can remember. And within those static shots, you're probably wondering, oh, what makes a static shot exciting? And I would say that, if anything, the animators work extra hard to make these static shots a lot more dynamic. One of these shots features a lot of diagonals when the camera is static. The camera is just sat there, but when Shinra and Sho are going at it, they're moving constantly back and forth to the camera, and because of Sho's movement as well and how he's insanely fast, that adds to the dynamism of the fight in itself, and so I would say that it kind of contradicts itself in a good way, or at least it proves that itself wrong, that a shaky camera is, yes, a good tool for showing off how rugged a fight is, but we don't necessarily need that all the time, and the animators do work really hard at doing that. The static shots as well are also just really good for showing the wider fight as a whole. We get the really lovely fire CG being showcased when Shinra makes that massive kick, which goes in slow-mo and sort of speeds up. That's also something I should credit them on as well. And then the wider shot, which is, it's from above, it's almost a helicopter view of Shinra just spinning around Sho, wrapping him up, and you get that fire trail throughout. It's just, I really like, one, the contrast between the flames as well as the color grading, which I said, but I also really enjoy the emphasis on showcasing Shinra's powers, and these are made obvious and they're made bright because of that very contrast. So what does Fire Force potentially teach us? It teaches us that fighting Sakuga is, despite there being a fight, and this might be a bit contradictory to the episode title, but despite it just being about the fight itself, one has to be able to create the mood for the fight and create the technical atmosphere for that to happen. The fire CG was, although there is some mix-ups from what I've read from Burrow, again, I'll be trying to make as many links as possible on my blog so you can look at those cuts for yourself, but what seems to be a lot of fire CG when it comes to what I'm referring to is just such an intentional choice, and intentionality, as I say across a lot of my episodes, is a very good thing. Intentionality within anime and production of media in itself is probably one of the best things you can have. These choices are made for the right reason, and they're made with conviction, and they're committed to making these excellent choices which make our anime so special. Everything has been decided and thought about to precision. Someone had to think about how are we going to color grade this? How are we going to transition between the colors? Because not all the cuts are within this grade. It goes to a lot more saturated color, and there's a lot less bloom for sure. But someone had to think that up. Someone had to choreograph these movements. And so I think I can say that the complexity of fighting Sakuga comes from how everything is constructed to create this antagonism. Everything has been thought out to make this antagonism seem as convincing as possible, for you to understand that these characters truly dislike each other or have some very deep-rooted problem, or at least rooted to the extent of which the animator and the director and the writer which wrote the source material wants you to believe. Now let's move on to our final anime. I didn't have a good segue. I know a lot of podcasters like segueing really well. I can't do that, and I've learned that. So let's just move on. And finally, the anime I have been basically addicted to for 3 days, quarantine has cursed me, is Fate Grand Order Absolute Demonic Front Babylonia, or just FGO Babylonia, that's probably what I'll be calling it, or FGO. FGO has been done by many people, actually, and in the case of FGO Babylonia, it's being done by Cloverworks. Cloverworks is a subsidiary to A1 Pictures. You will most likely know Cloverworks for Darling in the Franxx, as well as, I would say, after FGO, their greatest technical work, The Promised Neverland. And alongside Cloverworks, the subsidiary to A1 Pictures, Gemba, which is known for the tragic Berserk 2016 anime, works on the 3D CG. But don't be scared, because although you are probably listening to this and have watched FGO, I can tell you FGO definitely transcends any sort of judgment, I think, from the likes of its predecessor, First Order, and also just the Gemba name being attached to it. FGO Babylonia, I think, is just really special because of how it's evolved from the Ledus production. Ledus being the studio which worked on the First Order, the initial part of the story prior to the many singularities which they go in, Babylonia being the seventh arc, basically, so six arcs in between, and then First Order. And I'm not gonna lie, First Order from a visual point of view isn't splendid. It's not awful either. However, in comparison to Babylonia, it's a lot more flat. There aren't as many what you can describe as epic moments and displays of Sakuga, and on the whole, it just doesn't feel epic. I think that is the best way to describe it. FGO, as I was reading the summary, gave me this epic impression that it was a grand order, pun intended, but this was a massive deal, especially when you consider that this is an anime effectively about saving the world. And there are a lot of saving the world stories, but I like FGO quite a lot. And so I think in order to convince someone that saving the world is necessary, you have to really make your show as quote-unquote epic as possible. And Babylonia does live up to that name completely. The texture just pops out so much more versus the First Order. The 3D CG even just adds an element of texture and depth to the characters in some scenes, particularly the OP. And generally, I just think it's a lot more substantial and worthy of the Fate Grand Order name. And just a quick side note, because I think I might have missed that. Fate Grand Order generally, as like, I don't know if I can call it an IP, but I'm going to call it an IP, isn't solely worked on by Cloverworks generally, because we obviously have Ledus, but we also have an almost different artistic spin on it for the Camelot singularity that comes prior to Babylonia. It's quite a big arc, to be honest, but that is being done by Signal MD, if I'm not completely wrong, and that is a subsidiary to Production IG. So FGO is being worked on by a variety of people. I want to see how this shapes up to that, because FGO, I think generally, particularly Babylonia, obviously, has been able to almost transcend what I thought I knew about the small screen when it came to anime. And I would potentially say that this competes with some quote-unquote big screen content. And so how does it do this? How does it manage to compete with the big screen? And I do mean this kind of superficially. Do take it with a grain of salt. I'm not saying it competes with every movie possible, but it has, and I'm very intent on this, it has this cinematic feel to it, which I haven't been able to receive from some of the movies I have even seen. So, as I said, how does it manage to do this? And unlike MHA, which we discussed synergy about, I think Fate Grand Order Babylonia's animations and Sakuga is all about difference and about creating these individual characters within its animations. Different animators do things in different ways, as you would expect. It's not a monolithic art where everyone does the same thing and there is only one way to do it. And that really shows in Fate Grand Order, as we have multiple talented animators, some which work at Cloverworks, some which don't, pulling together to create some excellent scenes for these various characters. And I am very intent on the notion of various characters because of how FGO is set up. It's based on this three goddess alliance, and these three gods is, okay, you can include Enkidu as well, but these multiple characters and even the heroes in themselves have very different personalities and approaches. And so I think it's very great how the animators are able to compensate for that. And it's not necessarily separate animators for specific characters, but the techniques are very different between them when we see them in their respective parts of the show. A good example of that would be Yamamoto's approach to Ketsukoto. Yamamoto, from what I know, has worked on many successful works across the board. One of my favorites being Children of the Sea. He's also done The Promised Neverland. He worked on Mob Psycho 100 in some of the Keiji Mugami arc. And overall, I'd say he's a very accomplished animator as is, and is very skillful in what he does. And Yamamoto, I think, similarly to Nakamura, is just very bold in what they do, and they aren't afraid to challenge form and shape as is. And a good example of that would be, as I said, with Ketsukoto. So if I remember correctly, it's towards the middle of the show. It's in the latter half of the show at least, but the big fight with Ketsukoto and the main team really shows what he can do, and he's doing all sorts of things. He's skipping movement, so when she runs, he's not always showing feet touching the ground, and his use of smearing as well. Smearing being similarly, and I'm bad at explaining this, but similarly to smudging paint, it's not in its full form. Because it's in motion, it's almost blurred out. Similarly to if you are to put your camera on a low shutter speed when it shoots slowly, but you're shooting a fast image. That is smeared within the animation, and Yamamoto does that to an insane degree when animating Quetzal Coatl, but he also is able and isn't afraid to switch to very dark lines and very bold lines in the middle, and they feel very random and arbitrary, and I wouldn't be surprised if they are, although obviously they are intentional. But if it was something he wanted to just throw in, I wouldn't be surprised, because that is the nature of Quetzal Coatl. Quetzal Coatl is someone you can't really predict, because yes, they are part of the Three Goddess Alliance, but at the same time, they kind of have an interesting stance of humanity. So that conflicting personality of which Quetzal Coatl has is made up for and considered by the animators, which I would definitely say is very intentional. Ken Yamamoto, when it comes to form in general, particularly within these cuts, when Ishita gets knocked down as well, we get to notice that although hair would usually flop on the ground in that sort of situation, it manages to take up very rigid turns or forms versus a lot more curved forms which you expect from something which is quite realistic. And so I'll quickly just summarize what I'm trying to say about form, and that is just that form can be manipulated, that's obvious, but it's the fact that we are within this realm of non-realistic things because this is anime, and we're able to do that. We're able to manipulate and change things for our own perception, for our own enjoyment. And so I won't mention his name again, Nakamura, as well as Yamamoto, many others, are able to just do this as much as possible and wherever they wish to do so. Animators are able to manipulate things to create an intended effect, similarly to how writers use certain techniques to emulate a certain feeling or manipulate the audience's emotions. Animators do the exact same thing. I think a really good example of that within FGO as well would be some of the cuts featuring Ushiwakamaru. And I don't know the name of the animator which works on these, but they're able to create a much more grand perception of Ushiwakamaru. How do they do this? Impact frames, as I said earlier. Impact frames when coming into the scene. I think impact frames are just a really good way of demonstrating impact. I know that's really obvious, but I don't think there's any better way to enter a room over impact frames. It just draws so much attention to the figure in the moment as well. It's literally flashing at you. It's telling you, watch this scene. If you're looking at your phone and you're not watching, watch now. And it signals to the viewer, it guides the viewer and entices them into that very scene. We also get, during the fight with Gorgon as well, we get a really nice, almost Killer Kill-esque frame as well with these spark effects, or at least drawn sparks within one of the frames. And when you consider Ushiwakamaru's role, or at least this mighty warrior, she really is made that through the animators and the cinematography, etc. On the whole, a lot of the animations within Fate Grand Order are based on manipulating speed and motion, which sounds kind of obvious, I know, because that is almost one of the primary things an animator is supposed to do. But by playing with speed, making some very slow-mo shots throughout, even within one of the first fights between Anna and Enkidu, plus Mash, it's used so seamlessly. It's, I think when it comes to slow motion generally, it's using it in a way of which doesn't feel like you're slowing down the fight. Instead, you're just intensifying it. And so they don't glare out. It's not, oh, this is a slow motion shot, but it slows it down at the perfect moments for you to really absorb and understand what they're feeling at this moment and almost evaluate the stakes for yourself, for whether that's half a second. What I am trying to say and conclude at is that Fate Grand Order just brings so many talented animators together, whether that's Yamamoto, whether that's Wellen Zhang, whether that's Onsen, the list goes on. There are several people working on this, all of which are talented and work so hard to bring this 21 episode piece to look beautiful, and everything just flows together so well in terms of movement. I have almost no complaints, because every episode just features an amazing showcase of what these animators can do. And just a quick side point, I also really do appreciate Gemba's role within this work. But if a work like Fate Grand Order is using 3D CG, it does truly show that not everything is feasible, whether that's economically or just in terms of staff, is feasible to hand animate. And sure, I do wish that there weren't any 3D CG skeletons or any 3D CG background people or any 3D demonic beasts. I wish they were all drawn. However, it just shows. But it shows that although, sure, it might not be possible to do that because time and payment and economics, it's just not feasible to do so. It doesn't mean that it cannot be used to its advantage and it can't be made the best out of. And Fate Grand Order does that very well. And some of its shots, I think, are made because of the fact that they have access to such 3D CG facilities. Almost, I don't know if facilities is the right term to use, but the combination for the production, I think, is just a really good one. Especially as some of the shots are just so ambitious. All these rotations and close-ups on the likes of chains and even, I think it was in the opening episode of the second episode, Ishitar and Enkidu in themselves, even just within their introductions, are just made so grand through these shots. And that, I think, is only possible with this 3D CG. And so I think it's just something to be grateful for. Generally, there usually is quite this negative view of 3D CG, and I can understand it because it's been used in not necessarily the best ways in a lot of anime. But some shows and Fate Grand Order have definitely tried to reduce that stigma, which I really appreciate. So that is the analysis for this week. I will go into closing thoughts and kind of wrap everything up. And we didn't really talk about voice actors today, so I don't think there's much of a point doing a lengthy VA segment, but I will treat you to some more Fate Grand Order obsession because that's all I've really been watching this week. And so on that note, let's go into the In The Moment segment for Get In The Mecha episode 39. If you are new to the podcast, the In The Moment segment is probably the simplest segment ever. I just talk about what I've been reading and watching recently. So in this time of which we are quarantining, I decided with all the new shows I have to watch, I even put out a poll saying what I should watch and what I will watch. I will watch Isekai, I will finish it, I promise. But I just decided, what should I watch? I want to watch something with a bunch of sake. I know, Fate Grand Order Babylonia. And guess what? I've never watched the Fate series before. So well done, Jamal, for doing something stupid. But that has basically been what I've been doing. And that is why I'm recording this podcast on Thursday at 1 a.m. Because instead of writing and thinking, as I said last episode, bathing in my own mind, I've just developed this scary attachment to Fate Grand Order, and I have to watch at least, I don't know, 3 episodes a day, because I am damn enjoying this anime, and it's a variety of reasons. Maybe it's just my love for Sakuga, but I think it's also just I've been really jealous of the people on my social media timelines talking about how good and well animated this show is, and I agree. But I couldn't be part of the action, so I was kind of like the kid that got chosen last for the football match. But I am finally here, I finally joined a team, and I am watching Fate Grand Order. So I'll just give you a general overview of what I think. And I do like Fate Grand Order. I haven't touched any other show in the Fate series, and so I'm basing my knowledge and what I know of Fate as a series is coming from Fate Grand Order, the First Order, a Crunchyroll summary of all 6 singularities prior to Babylonia, and 14 episodes of which I've watched of Babylonia. And that means that I don't have any Fate works to compare. I haven't seen Stay Night, I haven't seen Zero, I haven't seen Apocrypha, I haven't seen any Fate show before. This is my first time, and so I like it. And I know not every show is like this, and some people have their preferences. I think the thing to acknowledge is that I know that Fate Grand Order is not perfect. It definitely isn't, but I think it manages to get around its imperfections as well as possible. I'm not going to go into spoiler territory because I've kind of spoken enough about it within the main podcast itself, but there are some parts which you can consider as fluffy in how it gets around them, and I can agree. But at the same time, I think it's the logic behind that is quite hard to question. It's similar to the conclusion of Naruto Shippuden I compared did in my head, kind of, how Kishimoto almost wrote himself into a corner, and he wrote himself out of it as well as he could, I think. And this is kind of a thing with Fate Grand Order, and it occurs multiple times because of how the show is set up. But I think any way of doing it which isn't that way would just create a lot more problems and implications, because people would be questioning how it would end up being what people would consider potentially a power of friendship move. Although I'm not speaking explicitly about the show, think of it like that. And I think everyone or a lot of people are tired of the notion of the power of friendship already, and Fate Grand Order doesn't do that, which is nice. It gets out of its corners as well as possible without being able to do that. Of course, driving yourself into those corners is questionable in itself, but it kind of works with how everything's set up. But what I'm trying to say is that FGO is not perfect, but I don't mind, because it does what it does really well, and its best aspects are great aspects. So that is my Fate Grand Order tirade over. Hopefully I will not go on one of those again, and maybe I'll slow down on talking about Fate Grand Order for a while after I finish it. I think it's just a temporary quarantine phase. But that has been the In The Moment segment. Quickly, if you have enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do get your podcasts. It would be really appreciated and helps share Get In The Mecha and these sorts of analyses and conversations which we have together. I say together, it's really just me talking to you, but I would also love you guys to get involved as well. And lovely segue, I said I couldn't do segues, but I can. Lovely segue. If you do want to get in contact with the show, you can email the podcast at getinthemecha@gmail.com. If you want to leave a question, if you want to critique what I've said, if you want to debate with me, there is a place to do it, as well as Twitter, that is @getinthemecha or twitter.com/getinthemecha. Talk to me, tell me how you feel about what I said about Fate Grand Order or the Sakugo of MHA. Did you hate Nakamura's UFO cut? Tell me how you feel about the podcast in general, and I will hopefully get back to you. And if I do like it, I'll even read it on the podcast. But before I go on for too long, let's wrap up this podcast. Here is closing thoughts for this week. So I think a good place to end this podcast would be just to discuss what I think I've learned from fighting Sakuga and learning about it, and what is the art, or at least the importance of fighting Sakuga. I think I've just learned, similarly to, I think I said this in the last episode of which we spoke about Sakuga, but production is so important when it comes to constructing the story. It's an obvious point, but it's also a very necessary one. The visual component is so important for padding out a narrative and making this narrative as convincing as possible. And all these choices which animators make matters in our perception, because we as an audience get to understand these characters not only from an informational point of view, but from a visual point of view as well, and that needs to work together very well. We can't have conflicting visuals and information unless that's being done intentionally, which it usually isn't. And so these choices and decisions have to be done to precision, and it's really lovely to know that the animators, at least within the works we've been speaking about, try to build up these antagonisms to perpetuate that very message. I think the art and beauty of fighting Sakuga, although those aren't necessarily the same thing, for the sake of argument, I think that comes out of just the various use of techniques and how bold animators are able to be. Everyone from Nakamura to Yamamoto are able to cast their own spin and manipulate our perception of a character simply through their movement and through their own personal drawings, all in the attempt to deliver a particular message. And so definitely next time when I do watch a fight scene, which will probably be tomorrow because I'll be watching Fate Grand Order, I and hopefully you'll be paying a lot more attention to these sorts of things. Thank you for listening to this episode of Guest of the Mecha. That has been episode 39. I don't even know how we're at 39 at this point. It feels like it's only episode 10, but that shows I've been having fun, and hopefully you are having fun as well on this really fun and wacky journey through anime and trying to understand it a lot differently. As always, I hope you guys are staying safe, and I will be here next week trying to entertain you with more anime stuff or manga stuff potentially. As I said last week, I don't know what's coming. I've been writing a few things here and there, so anything can really come up next week. I might just randomly do another Sakuga episode. Okay, I'm not gonna do that, but I could. What I am saying is be prepared for anything next week. That is it. I'll keep this outro short because sometimes I do go on a bit of a rant on the outro and I don't know why. But thank you for listening. Stay safe. I have been your host Shamal today, and this has been Guess in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows. 8-bit title screen by Joth. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. Difference by Chasers Gaming. And Anomaly, Barrack Media's UnderSoundImage.org.